Well, your scenario is a great example of how technology can be our friend, but it can also be an adversary. You know, we all can tout the positive aspects of technology, but clearly here, it does create issues with regard to redundancy that we just probably haven't thought about or given enough time to. And when a change occurs en route like this, how prepared are we to deal with that distraction?
Absolutely, Bob, and that's the point I made. There's too much studying to go through this analysis as we have just done. You have to do it before you take off. You have to think about, what am I going to do on this mission if this nice piece of equipment I've just spent a whole bunch of money on isn't working for me today? And it's just a new thing we have to put into our pre-flight thinking.
And isn't it just very, very clear to us? I mean, we sat here as we were looking at this scenario, looking at the approach plates. When you look at approach plates in mountainous terrain, all of a sudden they get real busy. I mean, there's notes on there, and there's a lot of information on there, which is good, and the information is all there that we need it. But how long does it take us to familiarize ourselves with this procedure, and how much time do we need to prepare ourselves to shoot an approach? And is that best done in flight, or as you say, on the ground in preparation?
Way too much to do in flight, unless you have a good co-pilot or a good autopilot. Way too much to do in flight.
You know, another way of approaching this, if you're going to an area like this where there are really unfamiliar approaches that are very complicated, as you said, they're very busy, is you could fly it on a desktop simulator before you go and kind of familiarize yourself with what this is going to look like.
And if you can't do it at your desk, who the heck needs to do it in an airplane when there's other stuff going on? And that's, as you say, becomes a real distraction for us. You know, there's other challenges with regard to using GPS approaches. And as we were looking at this, the responsibility for the RAIM check prior to takeoff. Let's review that for everybody, because it's a new change and everybody doesn't integrate it into their planning.
You're absolutely right. It's another piece of pre-flight planning or pre-flight checking we need to do. We can get it through flight service. We can get it through flightplan.com and some of the other sources. And, of course, just because we checked it and it said it was going to be reliable doesn't mean our equipment will always work, or that NOTAM isn't necessarily accurate. But at least it's a requirement to do it, and it's a step in the right direction, because if we realize there could be a problem with the GPS, then we might be more inclined to do this homework before we take off.
Sure. And once again, as we look at some of the options in our periphery, I might have to go to Albany. Well, if you might have to go to Albany, you need to know everything about Albany. And as we looked at in this scenario, when you really cut down to it, what was your option at Albany?
It wasn't illegal to do a VOR approach, but it was going to be right at minimums. It was going to be nighttime. It certainly wasn't a desirable situation for an alternate diversion.
And how easy would it have been to just get lulled into, well, we can go to Albany? Yeah, we can go to Albany, but it's a night circling approach at minimums. Well, you don't want to go there. You don't want to put yourself in that situation. But next thing you know, there you are, because you didn't give it the time and attention that it deserved to be considered a valid option. The mountains of Vermont, almost of necessity, are what we call a non-radar environment. Yeah. How often do us instrument pilots spend time in non-radar environments, and what kind of additional challenge and work does that create for us?
Yeah, we spend very little of our time, especially those of us that fly out east, mm-hmm. in a non-radar environment. And Rutland, as an example, is a non-radar airport. And many of these other alternates that we looked at are. And that just adds complication. It adds more time for the approach. It adds your requirement to be more up to speed on the procedures and not get stuck up there in those rocks someplace.
And removes the safety factor of having someone else monitoring your approach progress.
And when we were discussing this, at looking at the scenario, I mean, boy, we can remember those times when those words came to us, radar service terminated. Whoa, I don't like those words. Really just creating a little bit extra anxiety. Well, anybody, all those that need extra anxiety on their approaches, raise your right hand. And why is that? Well, it's because it's high terrain out there. It just gets us back into what we're doing, why we're doing it, and our preparation for doing just that. And do we always get into the what ifs? You talked about that. This is a classic example where, had we played the what-if game, we would have quickly identified, all our eggs are in the one basket, And when that basket, you know, starts falling apart on us, what do we got?
Especially because most of us are single engine pilots with single alternators and often single vacuum pumps and sometimes single GPSs. We just need to go through that what-if scenario on every instrument approach we plan. And if we don't have a suitable answer to those questions, we shouldn't take that trip. You know, another factor in this trip that just sort of happened is we had planned to do this trip pretty much day VFR. But now because we have to divert and it's getting later, our diversion is taking us now back into night IFR. So, or the potential for night IFR. So that's another consideration in our planning is, can we get away a little earlier? So if I do have to divert, I'm still dealing with day IFR rather than night IFR.
And the difference, you know, we just don't give enough weight and significance to the difference between night IFR and day VFR at the general aviation level. You know, for a trained professional who does it routinely on an ongoing basis, okay, you know, it's part of what we do. But it does create additional workload, additional stress, additional anxiety. And once again, we're doing all this with less and less feedback with regard to the outside environment. An interesting little tidbit that appeared as we were looking at the approaches and our options, we're looking at Rutland, Vermont, and we see they have an ILS-Y and an ILS-Z. Whoa, we don't see that every day. John, can you help us out with why we might have an ILS-Y and an ILS-Z at the same location?
Sure, Bob. At first glance, they look virtually identical. They're the same final approach fix, the same localizer, but the difference is the minimums. The one approach, the Zulu approach, allows you to descend lower, but it also has a requirement for an increased climb gradient on the missed approach.
Well, that might be important.
Yeah, obviously. So the further you descend into the rocks, the quicker you got to be able to climb to get back out and to be able to make those climb gradients. It's a relatively new thing that the FAA has been doing in some of these areas requiring gradients, climb gradients on missed approaches.
But we as pilots, you know, are always looking for the lower minimums because we, you know, I want to get in, I want the lowest minimums. But here we are missing,
and again, it's something that requires a careful pre-flight and careful pre-flight planning. The time to do the calculation for your missed approach climb gradient is not when you're coming up on minimums and deciding whether or not you can do it. You know, that really needs to be done back before you even depart. Am I capable of even accepting this approach clearance, and can I plan to do that? And what's going to happen? You know, Bob, you can talk about what you'd have to do on that approach 135, the legal requirements that you have for climb gradient.
Yes, you have to comply with these. And on the localizer Z, it's 300 feet per nautical mile.
And how do you calculate 300 feet per nautical mile while you're flying the airplane?
You have some math to do.
Exactly.
We all know that 200 feet per nautical mile is 3.3% because the books on the high-performance aircraft state the climb gradients in percentage. Mm-hmm. So 300 would be approx 4.9%. So now you're going to go into the performance charts and using the current weight of the aircraft and the altitude and the temperatures, et cetera, see what the airplane is capable of.
What does that look like for us in a Bonanza?
This particular case, 300 feet per nautical mile, if you were climbing at 600 feet at 120 knots ground speed, that would equate to about 300 feet per nautical mile. So it could be done in a Bonanza, but you're going to have to pay attention to it. You can't.
Exactly. And know before you even accept that approach.
You need to be able to get this performance out of the airplane, which is possible in a Bonanza, but it's going to require some attention, no fooling around in the climb rate. You're going to have to get it trimmed up into a climb and remain at that climb rate in order to comply with the 300 per nautical mile.
And you're going to have to keep that airspeed under control during the missed approach.
Exactly.
If you let the airspeed wind up too fast, you're going to start getting more nautical miles and not enough feet per minute.
Which is going to shallow out your climb gradient.
John, you also brought up another relevant factor with regard to divert and how it might affect our fuel planning. You know, okay, if we don't get in, we're going to divert there, and that'll take us 10 minutes. But does it always work out that way?
No. We look at some of the flight planning tools like flightplan.com and things. It puts a distance, a straight line distance between our airport and the alternate airport, not counting the fact that in this case, like at Rutland, the missed approach fix is like 7 miles away from the airport. So we're starting at that point. Now we're going to have to get some kind of routing, which may or may not be direct to the destination if we were going up to Montpelier, even though it's only 15 minutes away. By the time you get there, you do a procedure turn. You may not be next on the approach procedure. Might be somebody underneath you. You might have to hold and wait 10, 15 minutes. All of a sudden, that 12-minute away alternate's turned into a 40-minute flight.
That's a great point. And now if you've decided to divert back into the poor weather, you're getting deeper and deeper now. Yeah, that's another good reason to turn out to the good weather.
Or at least be aware of it in your flight planning, that it's not quite as easy as it looks.
And I think that's really the summary of this entire scenario. As, you know, on paper, this relatively straightforward trip, you know, from A to B, when you get down to the nitty-gritty and ask some of the what fors and whys, really create challenges that could overwhelm many a pilot.
One minor failure turned this trip from routine to a real serious situation, or could turn it into a very serious situation.
The DME is commonly used in approaches that define fixes. Stepping back to the avionics upgrade, probably would have been a good idea to keep that DME in the panel if there was space for it, to provide some redundancy, recognizing that the Garmin 430, 530, and the newer versions combine DME capability, ADF capability, VOR capability with common GPS. You get all your eggs in one basket. That basket fails. You're losing a lot of equipment with very little redundancy. You're most likely left with a VOR and a COM to work with, where that DME would provide some additional information and provide some situational awareness and serve to define these fixes on approaches that use DME.
And we do have to be very careful. You know, there's been changes that allow us to use WAS-approved or WAS-equipped GPS boxes now to designate an alternate. The AIM talks about that in paragraph 1120. And that's something that I'm not sure how many people are even aware of. And the impact that losing that has on you, it's not only affected your primary navigation, but as we saw in this case, it's affected your ability to go to your alternate because you selected your alternate based exclusively on GPS availability.
And the key takeaway in this scenario is that a wise pilot realizes that sometimes the best option is going back to where you started from.